Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast. KSJE is supported by San Juan Regional Medical Center, here to meet your urgent and emergent medical needs, whether they are COVID-19 related or not. Medical emergencies happen when you least expect them. Whether it's a stroke, heart attack, illness, or injury, San Juan Regional Medical Center's caregivers are here to provide care to you and your loved ones. Find out more online at sanjuanregional.com. Ten minutes past 8 o'clock. It is Thursday morning, the first day of April. Good morning, everybody. I'm Scott Micklin, and thanks for tuning in to KSJE 90.9 FM over the air here in San Juan County, New Mexico. Good morning, Durango, Colorado, where we're on the air at 103.3 FM. And good morning everywhere else where you can listen at KSJE.com. Welcome also to our viewers who are watching this visual radio program. We are streaming live this morning to the KSJE Facebook page, our YouTube channel, and our Twitter account. So however you found your way to us this morning, we are so glad that you are with us, because my guest this morning, the one and only Paul Reed, is going to be joining me in the next few moments, and we'll be talking about some changing and evolving museum policies across the country and across the world. That is coming up in the next few moments right here on KSJE, so please stay tuned for that. Then, of course, next hour, Megan Cullop will be joining me here in Studio A, and we'll be streaming our COVID-19 Community Information Program at 9 a.m. this morning. It is on the radio, of course, this afternoon at 5.06 p.m. And this morning, we'll be talking to our local doctors from San Juan Regional Medical Center, getting an update on hospitalizations, which are still down across New Mexico, and we're thrilled of that, and kind of what's next, and some of the work that they are doing now for what we call these long-haul COVID patients, the folks who had COVID, have somewhat recovered, but are still having some health issues. And so we're talking about that. Then we're going to be joined by New Mexico's Cabinet Secretary on Aging and Long-Term Services. She'll be here talking about the efforts to get the COVID vaccines out to senior citizens in our state. And then more to that point, locally, we'll be talking with Jessica Pilotti, who is the director of the Senior Center in Bloomfield. And she'll be talking with us a little bit about some of the local efforts to get the vaccines out to seniors, both at the Senior Center and seniors who may be homebound, who can't get out, as well as the rest of us. So it's a big show coming up at 9 a.m. this morning. We hope you'll stay tuned for that. You can, of course, watch it online, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at 9 a.m. You can hear it on the radio at 5.06 p.m. this afternoon on KSJE. Because on the radio at 9, Mick Hess is roving with the arts. It's our classical music program. Today, Mick is featuring music from Haydn and Grieg. You'll hear that coming up this morning on the radio at 9.06 on KSJE. Don't forget, of course, we want you to connect with us on our social media platforms if you're a social media person, and you can do that if you're a Facebook person, a Twitter person, or an Instagram person, and you can subscribe to our YouTube channel as well. Let's talk about the weather, shall we, for just a moment. Outside, it is 33 degrees with sunshine in Farmington at the moment. We are expecting a mostly sunny and mild day today. It's going to be a high of 68 degrees this afternoon. Overnight tonight, down to 42. And then take a look, though, increasing temperatures over the next several days, 70. Partly sunny skies on Friday with a low of 40 degrees. Sunshine and 77 in the forecast for Saturday, hitting maybe 79 by Sunday. 77 again on Monday before things drop back down to upper 60s Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, maybe middle 60s by the end of next week. But nice spring weather, overnight lows in the 40s as things are warming up. Well, let me introduce my guest who is joining me this morning. He is on the road this morning. Paul Reed, Archaeology Southwest and Salmon Ruins, is joining me this morning. And, Paul, it's good to see you. Thank you for coming on the program, as always.
Yeah, my pleasure, Scott. Good morning.
You are a road warrior, as we said, right? So good to see you. And today, the topic kind of about evolving and changing museum policies when it comes to artifacts and things that you and I talk about a lot of times here. You sent me an article from the Harvard Crimson, which is a student-run newspaper, a little bit about their museum, right? And some of the things that they have been discussing and having to come to terms with, correct?
Right. You know, as we've mentioned in prior shows, I think that the way museums are doing work, the attitudes they have, the policies that they're sort of bringing to their collections, these things are evolving tremendously here. And, you know, I think for many folks, especially in the Indigenous and Native communities, this is seen as way overdue. And, you know, I agree with that perspective as well. You know, in this specific case at the Harvard Peabody Museum, relates to the museum holding on to human remains and objects that were buried with folks, you know, what are called funerary objects, for much longer than they should have. So, yeah, I hope we're starting to turn the corner on this. And, you know, there have been some successes as well, which we can talk about.
Sure.
But I think the idea, sort of the longstanding tradition, and this isn't just America, it's Europe and Asia and worldwide, of museums warehousing collections, objects, and, you know, human remains, people, for decades, centuries. I think that's coming to an end ultimately. Or if museums are going to hold on to objects, variety ways, and I'm not saying the art museums are going to empty out tomorrow, so no one needs to fear, but it's a question of respectfully holding on to objects, especially things that are part of a different group's, someone else's cultural heritage.
Right, and I would think, and here we are two white guys talking about this, but for our Native American friends and neighbors, they would probably be saying it's about darn time that some of this stuff was acknowledged and fixed.
Right, and that's exactly right. And America is, I think, in a very different situation from Europe and Asia and other places around the world, because it is primarily non-Indigenous, non-Native folks, even in 2021, who are managing these large collections of objects and things that, you know, many of us value for different reasons. And ultimately, it's not a question of whether these objects should be considered valuable or important and should be treated with respect. You know, I'd like to think that most museum folks of whatever ethnic group that they've descended feel that that's important. But the question is, who has control? Who decides what might potentially go on display, what would stay in a collection, what perhaps should be repatriated to a group, especially once a group asks, you know, for an item back. You know, and of course, we're talking about this, Scott, in the context of a law that's been in place now for 31 years, which is the Native American Grave Repatriation and Protection Act of 1990. We call it NAGPRA, that's the acronym for
right.
Short. And this required museums beginning in the early 1990s to inventory specifically, you know, ancestors, human remains that had been held in those different facilities nationwide, you know, in many cases for decades or even over a century, and then to make the lists of those, you know, people, the inventories of people and the artifacts that were buried with them, as well as a category that's described as objects of cultural patrimony, which might be of specific importance to different groups. Example of that for folks are masks in the public world. You know, we've had several prominent return, you know, repatriation of masks from different museums and even a couple in Europe, which is heartening, to the Hopi tribe, to the Pueblo of Acoma, and to some other groups.
Right. I remember talking about that on this very program with you, Paul Reed. So
right,
it's great that it's finally, you know, getting out there. But as you mentioned, this has been 31 years in the making, right? And it was, I would assume that the federal government stepped in because it felt that the institutions and museums weren't doing enough on their own?
Well, right.
Or fast enough?
You know, some very, I would say, high profile with good publicity. I mean, from my perspective, maybe not so good from the museums, but high profile repatriation events happened in the 1970s and 80s and certainly at earlier points in time. But in general, you know, museums, the tradition of museums worldwide, and certainly in America, is to acquire objects, you know, hopefully, I'm going to put that in quotes, in legitimate and ethical ways, and then to hold on to those objects and, you know, and say, this is part of our collection. This is what makes us special. It makes us unique. You know, so this ties into things we've talked about before, Scott, with the notion of, you know, collecting things and holding on to, you know, valuable objects of art, you know, examples of, you know, really art in all its forms. And then, you know, in some ways honoring that and, you know, protecting that and understanding it. But the real problem is when we treat objects as simply art, we remove them from their context in many cases, and we sometimes lose the connection to the cultural groups that actually connect, you know, created that art. And that's a real issue, especially in America, because again, most of these museums in America are essentially warehousing the items of importance to indigenous and native groups who, you know, have been disenfranchised, who have suffered through many, many centuries of colonialism, and who don't have the opportunity to comment on how objects might be stored, whether or not they could be displayed, and again, you know, whether they should just be outright returned to groups that want them returned. So, yeah, and it's been a long process, but I think we might be starting to turn the corner on this.
Right, and to be clear, Paul Reed, I don't want to leave the impression that this law requires the museums return every object in their collection. As you mentioned, things aren't emptying out anytime soon, but there are certain items that may have cultural significance or human remains or those types of things that were specifically targeted by this legislation, right, to ask museums to document, to inventory, and then take the next steps, whatever that may be, correct?
Right, exactly. So for objects that don't have a connection to, you know, human remains, a human burial, or anything that was ever laid to rest with a person, you know, that the legislation isn't talking about those. And, you know, the other category is those objects of cultural patrimony. And that's why museums were asked to create inventories of objects like that, that might be of specific concern to one group or another, to one tribe or another. So we're not talking about opening the doors and saying, you know, come take all these things, we're going to turn these out and, you know, literally stop the museum industry tomorrow. It circles back to what should be in museums. How should we manage things? You know, what should potentially go on display? You know, how are those questions being answered? And if we have objects that we know are of importance to descendant groups, like tribes, but it could also be African Americans in different parts of the country, Hispanic Americans, Japanese Americans, a whole lot of different groups have objects of their cultural past that are held in museums, and those groups have very little say in many cases over that. You know, and then of course the basic issue is, should we ever have people, ancestors, human remains in museums? And the answer, I think, is a pretty resounding no. So in the specific case in the article that I sent you, Harvard has held on to, you know, multiple thousands of ancestors for a long time. And basically this came about in part because of, I think, what most people working with this, both, you know, on the federal side and in tribal settings and maybe in museum settings, would describe as sort of a loophole in this legislation, the NAGPRA legislation, that has allowed museums and institutions, anyone holding remains, to put them into a culturally unaffiliated category. Now, it's very challenging in many cases to say that a person from, say, 1,000 years ago is a direct ancestor to this modern day tribe. So, and I think perhaps museums overinterpreted the law and tried to connect every single set of human remains to a modern tribe. And that's a very challenging, if not impossible, prospect. So as I've worked with this with a couple different institutions, you know, it's become clear that the culturally unaffiliated category was perhaps meant well to allow, you know, so that perhaps human remains don't get repatriated to the wrong tribe and that you don't have those kinds of disputes. But ultimately, it has allowed museums to say, well, things are culturally unaffiliated. We're taking no action. The other side of that, or the next side, is that once a museum or an institution or a federal agency has published an official notice of inventory completion, and this goes into the, you know, the gargantuan Federal Register which gets published every day and has notices for all kinds of things. Once that notice goes in to the Federal Register, the museum has pretty much met its obligation under the NAGPRA legislation. And I think this really is the biggest problem with it, because what I think should have happened, again, having worked with this and talked to a lot of folks, I attended a virtual conference in October that talks specifically about these issues for museums and tribes. The missing part is, did the museum actually go through with consultation, and is that well documented? And were objects either given back to tribes who've made specific claims, you know, were human remains reburied respectfully, were tribes involved in that? So there's kind of this gap ultimately in the final reporting, the final disposition of what might happen, you know, through this legislation. Now, a lot of museums, to their credit, and the federal government has filled in some regulations for agencies, say BLM, Forest Service, who are dealing with these issues. You know, so they have regulations that say we have to go to this final step and demonstrate the repatriation, you know, in some form that was acceptable to the tribes, to the descendant communities, actually did occur. For private museums, though, and, you know, an institution like Harvard, this is definitely a shortcoming in the legislation. And ultimately, many private museums, you know, and this is a positive thing, many private museums and large public museums have gone through that final step, and they've tried to be very transparent and handle it. But there are many other cases where that hasn't happened.
Got you. And I guess it's encouraging that it's happening in some cases, but again, more work to be done. And I know, Paul Reed, you work a lot with Native American tribes and governments on this topic and many, many others. And so from their standpoint, can you share with us a little bit about how they are feeling, thinking, I mean, that this is long overdue, and then when they get these items back, are they able to either protect them themselves or display them with context in their own tribal museums and things like that, unless there's some sensitive reason why they wouldn't want to display them? But what's their angle on this?
Yeah, I think, as you might well expect, there are, you know, as many opinions as there are different groups and tribes that I've worked with and colleagues have worked with. So I don't want to overgeneralize, because that's another one of the issues that we've talked about a little. You know, different tribes, different groups bring different concerns to the table.
Sure.
But I think in general, the tribes feel that this is way overdue, that this process, you know, with this law passed in 1990, 31 years ago, this month or next, that's a very long time to wait for this process. The groups that we've worked with have been very willing to work and to consult, you know, fitting in the many other priorities for different tribes. And of course, the last year lost to the COVID-19 pandemic has not made any of these processes for any of the tribes easier. But they've been very willing to work to, you know, process that's unfolded at Solomon Ruins Museum over the last 3 or 4 years. Many groups have been able to travel to Solomon to consult. And that process has been very, you know, I think really good for both sides. And that's, of course, based on my perspective only. But with what we've heard from different groups, you know, they're very glad to be part of that process. And again, wish that, you know, this could have happened in a faster way. Now, on the museum side of the equation, you know, we are talking in many cases about literally millions of different objects that might have come out of work that the amassed collection held at the Solomon Museum is over 1.5 million objects, you know, in 10 different storage buildings on the campus there. You know, and of course, Harvard, I believe, has something like 20 to 30 million objects held in its collection. So we're not talking about a particularly easy endeavor to go through and do this. But that's why the federal government set aside money and grants that could be applied for specifically by museums or by tribes to do this kind of inventorying work and sorting out what's in their collections. You know, I think on the positive side for museums, many have been able to understand much better what's actually in their own collections, because part of this has been just a process of discovery. You know, museums have been sort of a depository, if you will, a place of deposit for objects, you know, for decades, if not, you know, over a century. In some cases, people want to donate things to museums if they feel like they're valuable. And so museums generally have had a policy of accepting objects, and that includes, you know, ancestors, human remains in the past, that, you know, museums took because they wanted to safeguard them. But that means that this long accrual process over decades, or again, over a century in some cases, has, you know, increased the sheer numbers of things that are held in museums and ancestors that are held. So it's been, it's a pretty lengthy process ultimately. Sure. And again, I think, you know, there have been proposed, adjustments, you know, to the law, and it's especially concerning culturally unaffiliated remains, to try to sort of get over that final hurdle because of you know, kind of the sheer numbers of people, ancestors who are still in collections. You know, the number I've recently read is something like 60,000 different individuals of indigenous or native descent still held in museums without an ongoing process to return or repatriate or rebury those remains. And all of those virtually are in this culturally unidentified category, which again really points out the, you know, the shortcomings of the federal legislation. You know, so I think there's still some hope as we've moved into a different administration with, you know, expanded priorities, more concern for things that have been neglected for some time, that perhaps there could be a fix to the federal legislation in this regard.
Right. Gotcha. Interesting. Paul Reed is my guest this morning, local archaeologist, of course. He works with Salmon Ruins and Archaeology Southwest. Paul, we had a question on Facebook about mummified remains. If they are included in this, I would assume if they're human, that would be a yes, right?
Right. Exactly. Any remains that are people, it could be those remains that are, you know, considered mummified or mummies, just other remains, human hair, literally anything, anything that was once part of a living person is covered under this legislation and gotcha. Ultimately should be returned, reburied.
Gotcha. Now, I guess to stick up for the museums for just a moment, I mean, you know, they do a great job of trying to educate us on history and cultures and things along that line, and they use some of these items or have used some of these items to come up with a broad exhibit and educational program for the public. Are you hearing much pushback maybe from them about that leaves a big gap in some of their efforts, or are they able to work their way around it? I seem to remember, I think when this first came into being, going to Aztec ruins in the museum there at the National Park about seeing some empty display cases with some signage that explained kind of why things were missing, why things had been removed from display because of this law that you mentioned.
Right, right. There was, I think, pretty well publicized cases at Aztec, at up in Mesa Verde, and in Chaco as well. So the short answer really from my perspective is no, this does not impact the ability to describe, you know, different narratives, different stories for what happened in the past. You know, the past, of course, is something that none of us directly experienced if we're talking about, you know, many, many years ago. So we have to really, I see my job in many ways is constructing appropriate narratives as to how to describe that. So to do that as part of my job, I don't require objects that, you know, either special objects that tribes have identified and want returned or taken off display. Certainly human remains don't have to ever be on display to tell that story. So I think that the empty display cases, you know, were basically a teaching tool for different museums. And I think the Park Service took that tact, and I don't honestly disagree with that because sure. Standards change. You know, we're interpreting things differently. You know, and the other thing I want to do is a shout out to the Aztec Museum at the National Monument. They recently redid the museum, I think, on a scale of about 5 years now. And it's a wonderful facility. They worked hard with different Native groups to get some of what, you know, the local tribes are concerned about into the museum. And to present things in a very respectful way, and really to update and modernize the museum. You know, Chaco has gone through that process as well, as we've discussed on the show. And, you know, it's still a couple of glitches down at Chaco just in terms of getting the environment controlled enough for some of these very special items that are going to be returned from museums on the East Coast and be on display at Chaco. So I think what we've learned, I hope what we've learned in the museum world, and certainly the work that I've done and what we do in archaeology, is that we can tell stories. We can tell, you know, different narratives about the past from different perspectives. And that's one of the things we've been working, you know, hard to do with different native partners as well, is to bring in something, you know, those perspectives that aren't necessarily derived through non-native archaeology. But we can do these things in museum settings. We can get very creative about it. You know, we have great multimedia at this point. We can do films, we can do audio. So, you know, I think there's a lot of potential there, and there'll be a lot of this will be realized as we envision museums as more than just places where we store things and sort of rotate collections through. You know, I think if anyone who's been to a museum in really almost anywhere, any American city, has seen the really exciting evolution, how we're creating interactive displays, you know, especially for young people, for kids, lots of very interesting things, and just a different way of presenting information, you know, even for adults. And doing that without sort of the old, well, let's just put all the objects on display and they'll sort of talk to us, you know, tell their own story. You know, we're evolving out of that, I think.
And that's a good thing, for sure. And let me go back to the article that you sent about this, the Peabody Museum. Again, nothing against East Coast folks and these great institutions like Harvard University, but, you know, I guess it goes to show some of these very powerful museums from a century ago, 150 years ago, right, that were some of the very first folks to fund some of these explorations of the Southwest, and that's kind of finders keepers type of mentality from that era, and this is what is changing?
Right. I mean, it's, you know, and for a lot of us, and certainly, again, not trying to speak for Indigenous and Native colleagues and partners, but, you know, this is a very painful period to a lot of people from American history. What happened in the late 19th century and the early 20th, and extending early into 1950 and beyond, is Eastern museums decided they needed to build collections, mostly of Native American, you know, items, and unfortunately ancestors. So people were sent out across the American West and Midwest and really everywhere, and they collected lots and lots of artifacts and human remains and brought them back to Eastern museums. And in many cases, there's been no interpretation, no narrative, certainly no collaboration with any of the descendant groups on these. And it's just, again, decades, if not centuries, of warehousing, storing people, ancestors, and collections without any intent to do anything else except to hold them. So this, I think, is definitely, you know, a dark side of the development of anthropology, archaeology, and museum work in America. And, you know, we're still trying in 2021 to take care of this and return items. One of the things I think it would help folks to understand is once items come into a museum, you know, it's very difficult to get items back out of most museums. You know, there are institutions created to hold on to things, to then ascribe value to them in different ways. And museum boards are made up usually of folks who are fairly powerful individuals in different communities and who take their responsibility seriously, which I think is okay. But, you know, the notion of repatriation is bumped up against, you know, we're holding on to objects of value for everyone and we don't want to give them back. And so I think that in part explains some of the reluctance. And I'm certainly not taking the side of museums here, because once a tribe or tribes have identified items, and particularly human ancestors, to be returned, repatriated or reburied, now the museum is an obligation to do that immediately. Again, it's this culturally unaffiliated loophole, this culturally unaffiliated loophole that's been a real problem, and really just the reluctance of museum boards of trustees to, in some cases, do the right thing and deaccession items and return them.
Sure.
You know, the other issue is just internationally, American museums hold lots of objects of great importance from other countries. And we've seen more and more requests from, you know, places like Mexico has done a couple of these, you know, where sovereign governments are coming through the State Department of America and then ultimately through the museums and say, these are objects that need to come back.
Right.
So I think we're seeing some positive, steps. And ultimately, I think that the philosophical question, Scott, is whether one group should actually own or control or manage the items of great cultural importance to another group. And whether this notion that objects are of great importance to people as a whole, and we often hear this, oh, this is important to humankind, this is global, we're holding on to this for everyone. Well, if that item is of specific importance to a cultural group that's asked for it back, then whatever the concerns are for, you know, holding it, curating it for the rest of the world, are in my mind clearly secondary to the concerns of that specific group. And then of course there are just people who want to collect items and hold on to them because they're special or unique. You know, and if they're doing that on an individual basis, that, you know, for me just basically comes back to greed. And, you know, and that's not a good reason to hold on to objects. Not in my view.
Right. Right. Well, again, going back to this article, Paul Reed, the Peabody Museum, again, they changed their policy, right? So they've got the message,
right.
It sounds like, that they decided that this is something that they're not going to do anymore, and they're looked at their policy that they have about returning items or deaccessioning items and things like that, and made that change and got their governing body, whatever the case may be, to go along with that, which is, I think, kind of this new awareness, right, of this issue,
right,
at these institutions that for years and years and years, centuries have held on to these things. And so the change is moving maybe slowly, but it seems to be moving in the right direction.
Right. And I think that's very positive, and I want to be real clear about that. I think folks would probably wonder why it took this long, but, you know, that is part of that slow change. I do think it'll be important to see, with this new policy in place, can Harvard then move more quickly to repatriate, you know, especially human ancestors, you know, those folks who fall into the culturally unaffiliated category, can they take concrete steps on a scale of a year or two to actually return people, figure out appropriate reburial places, and do those things? And that's particularly important. You know, one institution I wanted to shout out is the Denver Museum of Science and Nature has recently gone through this process, and there's a, you know, it's been very challenging for them as well. And they've also rewritten policy so that they're not going to be holding on to objects and certainly human ancestors that should be returned. So I think we're seeing a lot of positive change. You know, as we know, institutional change it can be very slow. But, you know, I'm optimistic for the next few years.
Well, good. Well, I think we all can be, and we appreciate you coming on the program to talk about some of these things that maybe none of us or weren't as readily aware of in the museum world and with our Native American neighbors. It's always important, I think, to understand kind of all of these different things that go into something that we consider as maybe normal as a museum display or going to see a traveling exhibit, perhaps. So thank you, Paul Reed. Always appreciate it.
Right, Scott, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
All right, enjoy your trip, and we'll see you back here next month.
Sounds good.
All right, thank you very much. That is Paul Reed. He works, of course, with Selman Ruins and Archaeology Southwest here in San Juan County in the Southwest, my guest this morning here on KSJE. Back with more in just a moment, everybody. The time is 8:42. Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.